We're all going through our dirt and we're supporting each other and we're learning from each other. And it just became a great group of people.
One veteran shares his struggle with PTSD, hoping that others might ask for help. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, August 1st. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, Alaska Native regional corporations seek to have their voices heard in Washington.
Anything I can do to help make our case quicker and stronger is pretty much the mandate for the job.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
You know that eating fruits and vegetables supports good health. But did you also know that frozen and canned produce offers the same health benefits as fresh? It's true. Whether fresh, frozen, canned, or from the land, eating fruits and veggies can lead to a long and healthy life. So when it comes to getting the fruits and veggies you need to stay healthy, remember, every bite counts. This message sponsored by SNAP.
Senator Lisa Murkowski says former President Donald Trump is innocent until proven guilty, but she also says the evidence is strong that he helped launch the January 6th attack on the Capitol. Murkowski was one of seven Republican senators who voted for conviction after the House indicted Trump the second time. She said in an emailed statement today that the evidence that's come out since then reinforces that Trump, quote, played a key role in instigating the riots resulting in physical violence and desecration of the U.S. Capitol on January 6, 2021, end quote. Trump today was indicted on four criminal counts, including two related to obstructing the certification of the 2020 election results. Senator Dan Sullivan's office did not respond to a request for comment. Representative Mary Peltola called the charges serious and said the riot was a threat to the country. She declined to comment more specifically about the case against Trump, saying that she did not want to create a perception of partisanship. Meanwhile, the U.S. Senate has passed a national defense bill that includes a 5% pay raise for service members and eight military construction projects for Alaska worth $168 million. The largest share of the project funding would be for a runway extension at Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson in Anchorage. The second would be housing for Fort Wainwright soldiers in Fairbanks. Senator Dan Sullivan issued a statement highlighting the Alaska projects. He also says he's disappointed Democratic senators did not agree to boost total military spending above the level President Joe Biden requested, which Sullivan called anemic. Sullivan's office did not respond to questions about the bill or an interview request today. His statement also credits him for getting exemptions that allow Alaska Native corporations to more easily win defense contracts. One exempts them from a proposed rule that would require defense contractors to disclose their greenhouse gas emissions. The pending rule is part of the Pentagon's plan to mitigate its climate impact. The House has also passed a defense bill with the same pay raise. The House version includes limits on service members' access to abortion and transgender care. The two bills go next to a conference committee. In hopes of having a stronger voice in Washington, D.C., a group of 12 regional Alaska Native corporations have created a new position. They've hired T.J. Presley as their first government affairs director. He says this new job reflects a growing need to educate federal policymakers about Native corporations, which were created by the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act in 1971. Presley works for the ANCSA Regional Association, formed to give Native corporations more political clout as well as promote their efforts to develop natural resources and win contracts from the federal government.
You're getting 5 minutes, 15 minutes, 30 minutes. There's a very brief window to make our case, and anything I can do to help make our case quicker and stronger is pretty much the mandate for the job.
Presley says Native corporations are among Alaska's biggest companies and have an array of business interests in Washington, D.C. that affect more than just their shareholders.
Alaska Native companies employ not just Alaska Native people, but they employ lots and lots of non-Native Alaskans, too. So they also underpin the very fabric of Alaska's economy, too.
Presley has been a longtime state legislative aide and worked for Senator Berta Gardner and Representative Bryce Edgman. Edgman, who was the first Alaska Native to serve as House Speaker, says Presley's legislative and state government experience makes him a good fit for his new job, one that's needed as Native corporations continue to grow.
Regional corporations, their business portfolios for some time now have expanded far beyond Alaska, actually in many respects, far beyond the borders of the country.
Alaska has 12 regional corporations and more than 200 village corporations that were created to settle Native land claims in Alaska. Alaska has the highest proportion of veterans in the country, and veterans face high rates of addiction, suicide, and post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD. But only half of veterans who need mental health care actually get it. Alaska Public Media's Rachel Cassandra talked with one Alaskan who hopes his story will convince other veterans to get treatment.
Veteran James Phelps is in a wheelchair rugby tournament.
To get a little desperate with the passes.
He throws his arm up and passes the rugby ball to another player who scores.
Wow! This is grim.
In June, his team took home a gold medal in the Warrior Games Challenge tournament. Phelps has mobility issues from his work. He doesn't need to use a wheelchair for his daily life, but through the Air Force's Wounded Warrior program, he learned to play wheelchair rugby, wheelchair basketball, and seated volleyball. They were sports he didn't think he was capable of playing anymore.
So along with that comes confidence and self-esteem boosts, a sense of belonging to something.
This sense of belonging is something Phelps has been working toward for 8 years. In 2015, he was at a fireworks celebration with his wife and infant daughter, and he thought he was dying.
All of a sudden, I just felt this blood rush out of my face. And I was like, I can't hardly breathe. So I'd like hand my daughter to my wife. And I'm like, we need to go to the hospital because I think I'm having a heart attack.
At the hospital, all his tests were normal. The doctors explained he'd likely had a panic attack. Veterans deal with high rates of PTSD, and fireworks are a common trigger. It's treatable, but the barriers to care can be high. Alaska faces shortages of behavioral health providers, lack of beds for inpatient care, and inconsistent services in rural areas. And counselors say veterans may be more hesitant to reach out because they feel like they should be able to handle things on their own. This is how Phelps felt at first. Until his mental health issues grew too big to handle by himself. He was already dealing with PTSD when he lost a best friend to suicide.
And that's kind of when the bottom fell out.
Phelps was having nightmares, panic attacks, and memory loss. He started seeing a counselor for grief, but he was struggling with much more than that. Then he went to an inpatient psychiatric hospitalization in Kansas City, Missouri.
And it was probably one of the hardest things I've ever done in my entire life. Because it was the moment I had to admit that I could no longer do my job. So it was also one of the smartest things I ever did in my life. It's probably the only reason I'm still here.
Inpatient care helped Phelps deal with the emotional fallout of his service and the loss of his friend. But after that, he wasn't sure where his life would go next. So his wife, Cynthia Phelps, secretly signed him up for a Wounded Warrior program in Colorado. She told him it would be a vacation. Instead, Phelps ended up at a one-week wellness intensive with wounded veterans.
I'm in a room with about 15 other people, and we're all going through our dirt, and we're supporting each other, and we're learning from each other, and it just became a great group of people.
That program allowed Phelps to start rebuilding that sense of purpose he'd lost when he left the military. Phelps's journey is a familiar one to Monique Andrews. She's a therapist and is in the Alaska Army National Guard. She's not speaking officially for the military, but in her private practice, she sees many veterans and people in the military. She says she sees a lot of PTSD in her practice, but people in the military face a wide range of mental health struggles, and Phelps isn't the only one who's had trouble asking for help.
There is a lot of rigidity around the role of being a military member. It is a role of reverence. It is a role of respect. It is a role of protector. It is a role of always maintaining control. And it almost leaves no room for error.
And Andrew says sometimes the people around a veteran or service member can miss signs that they're struggling. They may be more likely to feel their struggles in their body. Anxiety or depression might show up as neck or back pain. Or it may seem less like someone is struggling internally and more that they're acting out.
They demonstrate their distress in ways that can be off-putting to others through frustration response, irritability, risk-taking behavior, increased use of drugs and alcohol sometimes.
Coping skills like using drugs or alcohol may seem more socially acceptable in the military than going to therapy, but Andrew says these behaviors can be signs of real struggles with mental health. Phelps didn't turn to alcohol or drugs, but he wishes he had asked for help sooner. Because it's hard to do that, he wants to tell his experiences to as many veterans as possible. He's even considering taking a job telling his story to people having mental health crises.
My advice to anybody out there who's struggling with anything like this is to just to reach out. Don't be scared of it.
Phelps doesn't know exactly where his life will go from here, but he's optimistic. He's learned he can't always avoid triggers for his PTSD like fireworks. But when he hears them now, he has a whole kit of mental health tools to use. In Anchorage, I'm Rachel Cassandra.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a fan favorite returns to Brooks Falls for a salmon feast.
Even though, you know, he's not the fattest bear anymore, he's usually up there in the finalists pretty much every year.
Spoiler alert, it's Otis coming up. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
What gives you strength? Strength comes from teaching the Alaskan way of life, getting wood, fishing, hunting, helping people in the community, and being an example for the next generation. If you have forgotten your strength, remember, there's hope, there's joy, there's love, there's peace everywhere. Share what gives you strength at recoveralaska.org/share-your-strength. This message sponsored by Recover Alaska.
A child shot and killed another child in Mountain Village over the weekend. Village police officers contacted the Alaska State Troopers about the incident early Sunday. According to the troopers, the two children were playing with Nerf guns when one picked up a loaded rifle and shot the other. No criminal charges have been filed and the incident is under investigation. Troopers say the child's body will be sent to Anchorage for an autopsy. A 17-year-old boy died Saturday at a lake off the Treadwell Trail on Douglas Island. According to the Juneau Police Department, the boy was with two friends when he jumped into the water and did not return to shore. He has not been identified. The friends told police the boy surfaced briefly after diving but did not come back up. One of his friends called 911 Saturday afternoon. Juneau Police, Capital City Fire and Rescue, and Juneau Mountain Rescue responded but did not find the boy. Alaska State Troopers took over the search and found his body on Sunday. A trooper spokesperson said the boy likely drowned, but the state medical examiner's office would determine the cause of death. Officials say the area the boy jumped from was, quote, steep, treacherous, and difficult to move through, end quote. The Anchorage Health Department recently announced it was firing its contractor that runs the city's 24-hour pickup and sleep-off service for people incapacitated by substance misuse. A week later, the department said Securitas Security Services USA would stay on. The contractor's service has been inconsistent for months due to staffing shortages, but as Alaska Public Media's Jeremy Shea reports, the agencies that cover those gaps say inconsistent service is better than none at all.
Health Department spokesperson Michelle Farabach says Securitas has run the Anchorage Safety Patrol and Anchorage Safety Center for the municipality since 2016. But this year, prolonged staffing issues have caused repeated interruptions to the service that's supposed to run 24 hours a day.
They've pretty much been out of compliance for all of 2023. It's been an ongoing issue that we just haven't been able to correct.
Local emergency service providers have been covering those gaps, using ambulances to pick up some people incapacitated by drugs and alcohol, and taking them to emergency rooms instead of the sleep-off center. But if the contract were canceled, emergency service providers would have to pick up about 1,000 more calls a month while a new contractor was hired. On Friday, they weighed in with city leaders and the health department reversed its decision to cancel the contract. Anchorage Fire Department Assistant Chief Alex Boyd is happy with the decision.
The prospect of a complete closure meant that we had to pick up all of those incidents split between the fire department, police department, and that was a considerably larger number than we've seen recently.
Securitas is supposed to have at least one driver EMT duo patrolling Anchorage in a van at all times. In the Anchorage Safety Center, a supervised sleep-off space is also supposed to be open at all times with enough staff to monitor at least 45 people. But Fairbox says the van service has repeatedly lapsed. A recent health department report shows the safety patrol's monthly intake numbers this year are down by hundreds compared to recent years. Citing a company policy, Securitas declined to comment. Its current contract is worth about $2 million a year. Fairbox says the EMT shortage that Securitas is dealing with is a wider issue.
So I think there's a shortage statewide of EMTs, and that a lot of other places offer more competitive pay and benefits. And so that's been a big challenge for Securitas in keeping people.
Boyd says the fire department is seeing fewer applicants for its EMT positions, but it's still competitive and not impacting vacancies.
I hate to say this, but we may be contributing to the challenges that Securitas and other teams are seeing because our focus is more of a long-term career employment, and there's tends to be a little bit less career-oriented long-term employment.
Boyd says the fire department has 13 ambulance teams ready to go 24/7, but their focus is on emergency care.
We applaud the allowance of a little bit more time for us to potentially look at this situation and find a solution before we close up the contract completely.
In an email Friday announcing Securitas's contract would continue, Fairbox said her department and the company would continue to work together on staffing shortages. It's unclear what level of service Securitas is providing now. After the contract reversal, Fairbox did not return calls seeking more explanation. In Anchorage, I'm Jeremy Shea.
The Mat-Su Education Association ratified a contract with the school district this weekend after over a year and a half of negotiations. The union had voted to approve a strike in May after negotiations with the district stalled. Over the summer, the district changed their offer to increase pay raises and contributions to retirement and health savings accounts, but did not compromise on switching health insurance plans halfway through the year. MSEA President Vicki Hewitt says that members remain disappointed about the health insurance and that many have had to get planned surgeries and medical procedures reapproved and rescheduled after the switch. But Hewitt says the vote shows that teachers care about the community.
They care about the kids. They don't want to put the community and the students through anything more. You know, they've been through a lot in the last couple of years. So, you know, this vote was a vote for our community and for our students.
The union and district came to a tentative agreement on July 7th. The Mat-Su School Board will now vote on whether to approve the ratified contract at their Wednesday meeting. District officials declined to comment before the board vote. The contract runs from July 2023 until the end of June 2026. Classes for Mat-Su students will begin August 15th.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The IBEW is the union of skilled hands and generous hearts, hardworking people on the job and off. It's the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, the IBEW. This message sponsored by the IBEW Local 1547. Invasive plants and animals threaten Alaska's environment and economy and can spread to new locations by hitching a ride. Anyone can help prevent the spread of invasive species by remembering to play clean go, removing all plants, animals, and mud from boots, gear, and vehicles before entering and leaving recreational areas will help stop invasive species in their tracks. Learn more at playcleango.org. This message sponsored by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
Wasilla-based grocery store chain Three Bears is interested in taking over a popular general store in Unalaska. Alaska Ship Supply is a local landmark in the community, complete with iconic hoodies, coffee and groceries, a liquor store, and a large selection of fishing gear. Larry Soriano is president of Western Pioneer, which owns Alaska Ship Supply. He says they're considering selling the store, and Three Bears is the most recent potential buyer. Representatives for Three Bears visited the Unalaska store in late July. Three Bears marketing director Jim Kolb wasn't immediately available for comment on this story. The company has been in business for over 40 years and is expanding. In May, the chain opened up a store in Saxman near Ketchikan. Soriano confirms that there is no deal yet for Alaska Ship Supply and nothing has changed for store employees. Well, an insect infestation responsible for defoliating thousands of acres of the Tongass National Forest is abating. Scientists with the Forest Service believe that the black-headed budworm, whose numbers surged over the past 3 years, is now in decline. And while it's not clear how much lasting damage was done by the insect, there's a good chance that some parts of the forest may emerge from the infestation better off. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
I caught up with Gordy Williams by cell phone while he was riding the state ferry Lakanti from his home on Killisnoo Island in Angoon to Juneau in mid-July. It was a perfect day for a cruise up the Inside Passage and a perfect day to see the widespread damage caused by the black-headed budworm.
You know, I'm looking at Chichagof and Baranof. There are some pretty big impacts on the east side of these islands.
Those impacts are acre upon acre of defoliated hemlock trees, wide swaths of brown striping the otherwise endless green of southeast Alaska. The trees' needles, consumed by tiny, voracious caterpillars who are fueling their eventual transformation into the budworm moth. Williams worked for years in the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. He understands that budworm and its partner in crime, the hemlock sawfly, have a role in the forest, but this latest event he considers extreme. The Forest Service estimates 685,000 acres were defoliated by insects in the last 3 years.
It's a natural cycle, but when it does get ramped up like this, it does have a pretty significant effect on the ecosystem. So what our curiosity is at this point and our concern is, what are the impacts of this radically thinned out forest canopy in so many areas? You know, that's what provides winter cover for deer and other animals, and is it going to impact stream temperatures and that kind of things?
This part of Chatham Strait is notorious for winter storms, huge sou'easters that blow right up the channel between Admiralty and Baranof Islands and can make this ordinarily pleasant ferry ride a bit of a stomach churner. Hemlock sawfly stressed these trees in 2018 and 2019. The black-headed budworm infestation followed in 2020. Forest Service entomologist Liz Graham described it as a 1-2 punch to the forest, putting it on the ropes. The weather may have finished the job.
It definitely seems to be on some more extreme sites too, the ones that are really heavily exposed. And so I do think that it's a little bit more like compounding impacts where there was heavy defoliation and then maybe on top of that, a big windstorm or ice storm, and that really kind of stripped the last of it. And so I do think that that's why we have seen some of those areas with really more dense mortality, that it's there's been more than one event there.
Graham said that depending on the area, up to half of the hemlock trees may have died. Although this sounds like a high toll, Graham's colleague, silviculturist Molly Simonson, says on a forest-wide scale, the damage is limited. Most areas are unaffected, and some forest die-off is not necessarily a bad thing.
You know, trees do die, whether it's clusters of them, you know, during a particular event, or whether it's just individually over the course of that forest development. But you know, it contributes to nutrient cycling within the ecosystem, and there's always going to be other trees in the understory waiting to take over that space. There's regeneration underneath those dominant trees that are just waiting to take over, and they'll capitalize on that.
The last major black-headed budworm infestation in the Tongass was in the 1950s, and good data are hard to come by. Liz Graham says tree ring studies could help her identify the timing of the budworm cycle, but humans are throwing new variables in the mix. Climate change, or specifically the number of frost-free days, could play a role in outbreaks, but warmer weather can also disadvantage budworms.
The budworm populations actually extend all throughout the Pacific Northwest, and so the outbreaks that we've been experiencing here have really just been happening in Southeast Alaska and haven't extended to BC. And so some of the research we've been looking at, it might be actually too warm down there. So it could be that we're in this perfect little climate window right now for budworm outbreaks.
Although the outbreak in Southeast Alaska is subsiding, there are some areas where budworms are peaking, notably Juneau and Haines. Picture a slow-moving budworm tsunami that began on Prince of Wales Island and traveled north. Defoliation is not certain death, however. Trees that were stripped near Gordy Williams' home on Killisnoo Island are sending out new buds this year, as are many along the route of the Lakanti as it steams up Chatham Strait.
We'll just have to see how many of those trees can come back and how long it takes.
Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
A consistent contender for the fattest bear and one of the oldest males at Katmai National Park has awoken. Bear 480, also known as Otis, arrived at Brooks Falls on Wednesday last week. Fans had feared the bear had passed away, but as KMXT's Brian Venois reports, the elderly ursine just slept in before making his first appearance on the National Park's live cameras.
Katmai National Park has a 24-hour live stream of Brooks Falls every summer. It's where hordes of bears gather to catch salmon and a popular spot for crowds to watch them. Otis has become sort of a fan favorite. Felicia Jimenez is a media ranger for Katmai National Park. She says his late appearance is most likely because of a later salmon run in Bristol Bay.
Things are a little bit slower to wake up, and, you know, we're definitely seeing that with the salmon run. The water level is a little bit higher. The water level has been colder, so we've been seeing the salmon a little bit slower to arrive, I'd say about a week or two late.
Bear 480 usually comes out in late June or early July. Some fans thought he might not have survived the winter, but Otis finally showed up on the park's cameras last week. Jimenez says most bears that get to that age usually rely more on scavenging or begging for fish from other bears, but the public ought not worry about Otis. Bears usually live to about 20 years old, but she says he's still pretty spry for a 27-year-old.
There's still really good signs that we're seeing from him. He's super old, but I mean, he's still very active. When he showed up, he was immediately catching fish, and you know, those are positive signs. He's still active. He's still moving around.
Viewers of the National Park's live cameras can identify him with a few gray and white swirls in his brown coat and some damage to his left ear.
He also is missing a lot of teeth. He only has about 2 teeth. So if you see a bear with a floppy left ear who's pretty old and he's got like 2 teeth, that is definitely 480.
Otis is also a consistent contender for the title of fattest bear at the falls during the National Park's annual Fat Bear Week in early October. Park rangers create a bracket of some of the biggest bears that wander the area, and the public can vote online for the fattest bear around.
That competition is pretty subjective, so for their favorite or which bear they think embodies fat, healthy bears the most. And so even though, you know, he's not the fattest bear anymore, he's usually up there in the finalists pretty much every year.
Some of his rivals for the title include Bear 747, sometimes called Bear Force One, who won last year, and Bear 435, also known as Holly. With a later arrival, though, Otis will have his work cut out for him if the old man wants to be declared the park's fattest bear a fifth time. Watching the cameras from Kodiak, I'm Brian Venois.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin, Rhonda McBride, Rachel Cassandra, and Jeremy Shea in Anchorage, Francisco Martinez Cuello in Bethel, Yvonne Crumry in Juneau, Andy Lusk in Unalaska, Robert Woolsey in Sitka, and Brian Venois in Kodiak. Our audio engineer is Chris Hyde, Tim Rocky is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
ConocoPhillips Alaska, building the next generation of Alaska's workforce through investments in education and vocational training to provide jobs right here at home. ConocoPhillips Alaska.
And by
Northern Air Cargo, providing cargo transportation to 9 Alaska communities. NAC offers options including cargo charters to get freight where it needs to be. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.